is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, June 18, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. Well, today we'll be talking with venture capitalist Roger Ehrenberg, a crazy baseball fan who's been writing about the negotiations, and we'll get his perspective on the latest offer from owners. And we'll be speaking with Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo Sports, who talked to rank-and-file employees about what they're seeing in this stoppage between the two sides. I mentioned the offer from Major League Baseball. They sent that proposal over after a Tuesday meeting between Commissioner Rob Manfred and Union Chief Tony Clark. In that proposal, 60 games at full prorated pay. The season would start on July 19th. Sources on both sides of the negotiation said there's an expectation that further talks will result perhaps in proposals in the range of about 65 games. The proposal also has expanded playoffs and includes the union waiving its right to grieve Major League Baseball. Want to make this clear, no deal is done. After news of this broke yesterday, Rob Manfred put out a statement in which he said, at my request, Tony Clark and I met for several hours yesterday in Phoenix. We left that meeting with a jointly developed framework that we agreed could form the basis of an agreement and subject to conversations with our respective constituents. I summarized that framework numerous times in the meeting and sent Tony a written summary today consistent with our conversations yesterday. I am encouraging the clubs to move forward, and I trust Tony is doing the same. We've heard the talk about the possible grievance that Major League Baseball is concerned about with the Players Association. And I got to tell you, reading that statement from Rob Manfred, it read like a lawyer checking all kinds of boxes potentially to undercut any claim that would be put forward in a grievance if it doesn't work out. I can tell you that the initial reactions from the player side, they want more games. Incredibly, the difference between the two sides, a 60-game proposal, full pay versus 70 games, is the value of Steven Strasburg's contract, about $245 million. That's in a $50 billion industry. Now, before we get to the interview with Roger and the interview with Hannah, we need to mention our friends at Marathon. Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for the high quality, top tier gas. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your engine running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and by reducing emissions. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon, every day, with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, and more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Hannah Kaiser covers baseball for Yahoo Sports. And Hannah, you had a great story that posted this week about the responses of staffers, team staffers around the game to what's going on. I feel like it's a really important perspective. And we'll get to that in a second. But yesterday we had a development in these negotiations between the players and the owners. Major League Baseball forwarding a 60-game proposal, full pro rata. This based off a meeting between Tony Clark and Rob Manfred on Tuesday. What you heard from folks around the game?
Well, initially, what I heard from folks around the game was people on the player side being like, "Don't believe what you've heard that there's an agreement." So that was, and I think we sort of, everyone who covers the game and who was paying attention to this sort of worked backwards from that. That initially it felt like maybe we already had a deal and something was done. And so initially what I heard was, all right, be optimistic, but not quite that optimistic. Is that sort of what your experience with it was? Was that like originally it felt like we jumped all the way to like, this is it, there's going to be baseball. And then there was a period yesterday afternoon of sort of ratcheting back that optimism a little bit, which personally I thought that even if we're trying to mitigate some of the optimism and we're trying to make sure that we get everything, dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's before people start celebrating opening day, that this really does feel like a big step, that they're at least sort of finally speaking the same language. And it felt like a lot of the intractableness of the negotiations was the fact that the players, they had no reason to come off prorated salaries, and they had the sort of legal standing with the March 26th agreement. And also they would weaken their own position if they ever did that. And so it felt like as long as the league was proposing pay cuts, that there was never going to be a deal. And so even hearing from around the league that, you know, temper your optimism and we don't have a deal yet, I'm a little bit optimistic.
I'm not sure how I feel yet. And you're absolutely right about sort of the flow of what the reaction was according to the information that came out when it did. I think everybody in the sport that I talked to was encouraged with the fact that, hey, they're talking.
Yeah.
Rob
yeah.
Manfred acknowledged in his interview with Mike Greenberg on Monday that they hadn't been talking. So that was a good step. And then for the first time, we had the owners giving an offer with full prorated salaries. But then I got to tell you, as I talked to people on the player side, as the day went along, and then early this morning, as I was texting back and forth with people, so much reaction was, okay, what's the rest? Where's the other stuff? What, you know, isn't there more? Like, there's going to be more, right? Because initially, what I was hearing from folks was with 10 off days built into that 60-game schedule, there was room for maybe to push it to 65 games, 66, 68, that sort of thing. And I think initially there was an expectation among some of the agents that I spoke with that, yeah, well, there has to be some mechanism in place, right, to help free agents or something that spins forward and helps us build a bridge into the future. But at this point, we haven't seen it yet. And it also jumped. And I'm curious if you felt the same way. Like, you know, the news first came out, 60 games with full prorated salary. And right after that, Rob sent out a statement. And as I was processing that statement and then talking with people afterward, man, it felt like a lawyer checking boxes and trying to cut off a grievance. First off, the first words at my request, Tony Clark and I met, which was, you could paraphrase it, well, we tried. We tried. When we talk about good faith negotiation, at my request, we're trying. We left that meeting with jointly developed framework, paraphrased, we're trying. We went over the framework numerous times. We're trying. So I felt like Rob was kind of subtly trying to cover all those things while having these conversations with Tony. And by the end of the day, what you heard from the other side was, you know what, we didn't feel like we were as close as what was indicated in Rob's statement.
Yeah, I felt like what Rob's statement was really doing was trying to kind of publicly put a bow on these negotiations and say, we're there. Like and even sort of in the way the information flow happened yesterday, it really felt like what the league side was trying to do was give the impression that this is the deal. This is what we're going to do. And, you know, I made this grand gesture of flying to Arizona, and it felt like he was sort of almost trying to goodwill Tony into a corner by being like, you know, Tony was great and we talked and we're, don't worry about it. And they were sort of trying to forestall a counteroffer by putting out there that, like, we made this great effort and it worked and now we're good. And it was, and it felt like, and that was sort of the impression I got talking to the player side, was that they felt like that was what was happening. And they were sort of like, wait a minute, this is premature. Don't believe, we absolutely want to look over all the details and make sure that we get a chance to counter, and that, you know, if we want some of the other concessions and sweeteners, that we have a chance to sort of talk about those things. So it felt like, and maybe I'm wrong, because I didn't talk to that many people on the league side, but it did sort of feel like the league was maybe trying to, like, rush it through. I'd be like, yeah, no, this is good. Don't, nobody needs to counter. Nobody needs to, there's no, we're not, you know, we're, everything's great, guys.
I did Golic and Wingo this morning, and Mike Golic, who's, you know, played in the NFL, I thought made a really great point about how we look at, you know, the offers that are being made from the owners comparable to the contracts in the NFL. Because as you know, when the deals that we see in the NFL, they're initially announced 8 years, $600 million. When we all know the only number that really matters is the guaranteed money. You know, how much money is guaranteed? Is it $50 million? Is it $45 million? And that's the number that I become increasingly focused on in these owner's offers. And the fact is, that number didn't change that much. The previous owner's offer had been for 83% prorated salary for 72 games. And this is 100% salary for 60 games. It pretty much is the same lump of cash.
which really begs the question, why did we not get to this particular place a couple weeks ago?
Yes.
I think that's the real frustration that I feel, and I think a lot of people around the game feel, is like, look, the union has been clear, adamant, expressive about the idea that they're not entertaining offers that don't include prorated salaries. And so if this was an opening offer from the league, or maybe a second offer from the league once that was established, it does feel like, and you referenced, Buster, the idea that like they're finally talking. If they were talking all along, could we have gotten to this place weeks ago, maybe before there was so much ill will and so much acrimony that it didn't feel like they were sort of willing to keep talking? If we could have gotten to a place of like, if the owners were like, here's the pay cuts we want, and the union sort of said, look, just putting this out there, like our best and final offer, we're never moving off prorated. If the owners had been like, great, how about 60 games? And then they could have said, how about 70 games? It does feel like we really, because they weren't talking, and because the ownership side sort of floated three virtually mirrored proposals of various percentages moving around, that we not only wasted a lot of time, but wasted a lot of like goodwill both on both sides of the actual negotiations and then around the game.
You're 100% right. If in fact they reach a compromise, I feel like that should be the first question to Rob Manfred when he meets with reporters. Why did it take you this long? Why wasn't this offer made 5 weeks ago? Because the damage that's been done to the sport in the interim, I feel like it's going to last for a lot of years. There's such frustration, and you live in New York just like I do, and it's almost felt the entire time like the two sides, particularly the owners, have been absolutely tone deaf to the larger situation in this country. I mentioned you did a great story that just posted about the responses of staffers anonymously, because of course, you know, they need to talk anonymously or else they're going to lose their jobs. About what's going on, what are some of the things that you heard?
This was really, really interesting. So I'm going to like very quickly give the backstory of how this came about, because I think that's sort of interesting too, that I was actually working and still working on a feature about how this will affect how either a total lack of baseball or even sort of like a shortened season and some of the rule changes will affect industries around baseball. So talking to Louisville Slugger and Rawlings, and what I sort of kept hearing from them was this like tepid optimism tinged with fear that you know, if there's no baseball, there's a lot of people who are affected. So then I started talking to friends that I have around the league, and importantly, I should say, to protect my sources, that no one who I know personally was quoted in this story. It was all people who are multiple levels removed. But once I had this idea of well, there's so many, like the ripple effects of who is affected by this is so great. I just, you know, started, put out a call and made it known that I was interested in talking to people, and heard from a lot of people. A couple of things came up. First of all, they hate the millionaire versus billionaire dichotomy that is so popular in both media and on Twitter and amongst fans, because it really does ignore that, it's not just people who will be fine no matter what, and isn't your job so good anyway, that a lot of people have sort of, you know, regular desk jobs that they went to college for and that they, you know, started at some intern level making $12 an hour and they just want to have a career, and their jobs are just as greatly, if not more so, affected by how much baseball we play and when we get baseball started. So that was the first thing, was this idea that like, there's just this huge swath of people who don't feel like they're even part of the conversation in terms of being at the table, or part of the conversation in terms of the derision people have when they sort of talk about the greediness around sports. And then I was very interested in who they thought was to blame. And although I had one person who was mad at the players, virtually everybody else said the owners were at fault. Even people who work in the commissioner's office who are, you know, fine in terms of not having pay cuts and not having furloughs, and they appreciate being protected and all that. They really do feel like, you know, to quote somebody, that the owners are just willing to throw it all away. That is the sense they got. And specifically, so I quoted somebody in the story who talked about this statement that Major League Baseball put out following the union saying, you know, the when and where we're ready to play. The Major League Baseball put out a statement that referenced all these employees and sort of said, well, you know, we're economically responsible for these people, and the players are making that difficult. And the people I talked to were sort of like, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse in your podcast. That's BS. We feel like they're using us as pawns. So I heard that from one person who I quoted in the story. And then, you know, the best way to get people to reach out to you is to publish something. So, of course, since then, I've received significantly more feedback from people all over. And that particular statement has come up time and again, that actually people who were being referenced by that statement as dependents of the league and reasons why the players should capitulate don't want to be used like pawns like that. They think that, you know, that the owners should pay the players what the players say they deserve, and they should not use these other staffers as leverage, almost, and sort of as almost hostages to say you're preventing us from keeping these other people employed.
The rage that what you're describing, the rage, the anger, the disgust, mirrors exactly what I've heard from people around the game. They are appalled by what's going on here. And as you said, they don't like the millionaires versus billionaires narrative, because there's so many people who don't have access to wealth who are caught up in this thing. Like, they are absolutely, and their lives are being batted about as these incremental offers come in from the owners. And they're really angry. And one person say to me, speaking of fans generally, they hate us. Like, they hate us. I've had people in the game say, I don't like baseball anymore. They're really like, it's almost like I'm listening to people like do self-assessments about their direction in life.
Absolutely. Read the piece, please, but I'll spoil it for you. The kicker on the piece is someone who said, you know, I was working on a cover letter for an NBA team right before I talked to you. They really do feel like, in addition to how frustrating this is and how like angry making it is, that the actual sort of future of the sport is in jeopardy, and thus the future of their careers. And on that point, I really want to like emphasize, because I this was unexpected and I thought sort of heartwarming. A lot of people I talked to, so everyone I ended up talking to was someone who has like a desk job. So marketing or media relations, or a lot of sort of data scientists and engineers and analysts and that type, and some baseball ops people. And a lot of those people said, I'll be fine. If I have to leave baseball, I'll leave baseball. I'm concerned about the overall direction of the sport and how that will affect the sort of quote unquote baseball lifers, the guys who were counting on going on to be coaches. And multiple people that I spoke to referenced the contraction of the minor leagues and the slashing of the draft this year from 40 rounds to 5. And the idea that it just doesn't feel like baseball as an industry is growing, that they're concerned that there are sort of a lot of guys around the game who are just going to get squeezed out in the next couple of years, and who don't have these like data science degrees that they can take to an NBA team or take out of sports entirely. And I think that that's important to emphasize, because we shouldn't have to emphasize that, but I know from Twitter that people will say, well, you know, these guys work in sports, they're so lucky, like, why should I have sympathy for them? And a lot of these people were saying don't have sympathy for me, but do have sympathy for the fact that this industry is shrinking, and that's going to leave a lot of people unemployed.
That's 100% in line with what I've heard as well. No question about it. And a great job on that story. And thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Buster.
Roger Ehrenberg is the managing partner of IA Ventures and a baseball fan, and he's written extensively about the current situation. Roger, how you doing?
Doing well, Buster. How you doing today?
Good. Thanks for joining us. And just for the context sake, I want to talk about your background. Can you describe your company and what you do and any connections you have with owners and players?
Yeah, sure. So IA Ventures is a venture capital firm. Me and my partners, we seed exciting technology companies And, you know, before that, I was on Wall Street for almost 2 decades in trading. And I actually have absolutely nothing formally to do with the game of baseball, except for the fact that I love it deeply and it's given a lot to both me and my family.
What's your first personal connection with baseball? Like, who was your team? Who was your guy?
Yeah, so funnily enough, I really got into baseball when I lived in upstate New York, and I really loved the Boston Red Sox of all teams, and Jim Rice was my favorite player. And I remember, you know, following the Red Sox teams of that era with, you know, Freddie Lynn and George Scott, Butch Hobson, Bernie Carbo. They were really a compelling group of characters. And I would go away to summer camp and I'd follow the box scores. And I was just super, super excited about the mid-70s Red Sox.
Yeah, those were a team. By the way, I grew up in central Vermont. And so I wasn't a Red Sox fan, but because they were the only team I could hear on radio on a daily basis, that was the team that I followed as well. Boomer Scott playing first base for the Red Sox. What got you interested in writing about baseball, as you have for anyone who follows you on Twitter?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I started blogging after I left Wall Street about 15 years ago, and it's just become this vehicle for really just sharing kind of thoughts about things that I wouldn't ordinarily be involved with day to day, but where I have some pre-existing knowledge and a lot of passion. And so I literally never written about baseball until really a month or so ago, when I could see what was happening with the, you know, the player owner dynamics and the kind of the way I suspected negotiations would go in advance of them being released. And once I started writing about it, Buster, it just released all of these thoughts and feelings about the economic model, the fundamental misalignment, and the fact that, and I felt this for a long time, that as beautiful a game as it is and how it's something that I think has done so much for this country, it's also really, really broken and in need of fixing.
What's your read on the current negotiations? We, of course, got that the latest proposal from the owners yesterday, 60 games, full prorated salaries.
So I guess my feeling is that, you know, this is really just a tactic by Manfred and the owners to run out the clock on how many games can actually be played in order for them to get back to that notion of 50 games, but kind of having a safe harbor against the grievance. I don't think it's at all responsive to player needs. And this is really just a repackaging of earlier offers, with headline pro rata being given, but only 30% of the dollars. And of course, in the play, you know, extended playoffs, you know, no share of broadcast revenue, the $25 million minimum. It's really a kind of a far cry from really what the players deserve per their contract, or even in the notion of fairness.
I've been shocked by the incrementalism of the owners. And I feel like, and I wrote about this the other day, I feel like that they're not tending to their product big picture. Like I watch this, you know, play out, and I talk to fans and I receive the responses on social media. And I feel like that the potential risks that the owners are engendering here with how they're handling this versus the possible rewards if they actually come back are I don't understand why they're doing this. For example, you know, I began to think of it in these terms today, that the difference between these two sides, if the owners were to give the players, you know, 70 games full prorated salaries, the difference between the two sides is one Steven Strasburg contract, which I find to be crazy to me. That's where we are in this thing.
Look, I actually read your piece on that, Buster, and saw your tweet, and I couldn't agree more. And, you know, part of the motivation for my writing has been to kind of educate the general public on kind of the owners have managed the frame and want to control the narrative and paint the players as greedy and selfish, when in fact the inverse is true. So what you're taking the rational perspective. That is not at all what's going on here, Buster. And I think there's likely tremendous misalignment among the owners themselves. And you've got the old guard, which have this history of just wanting to keep the players down. And it kind of doesn't matter about the long term. They've been repricing broadcast deals at higher and higher prices, getting more attractive sweetheart deals from municipalities on building new stadiums. So really, they've kind of calibrated player economics to tickets, which, of course, attendance has been declining every year for the last seven. And even with increased ticket prices, it's not, you're not seeing increased ticket revenue, yet all the value increase has been in broadcast. So from the owner's standpoint, they want to hold the line, because with the 2021 CBA coming up for renegotiation, the last thing they want to do is show weakness. Now, of course, my fervent belief is they are absolutely damaging the long-term value of their asset, because if I'm the players right now, given how I've been treated, I'm striking. Like, the 2021 CBA is a chance to refactor the entire economic model, because things can't go on the way they are.
I'm going to put you in advisor capacity for both sides. First, if you were, and I've tried to, you know, from my perspective, covering this sport for a long time, I really feel like the last truly semi-independent commissioner was Faye Vincent. And since then, you know, the person who's sitting in that role has been Bud Selig, a former owner, and now Rob Manfreda, who's the lawyer for the owners. If I were to put you in that position where you were chief financial advisor for the owners, what would you say to them about what they should do?
Well, firstly, I would have advised them very differently on how this whole process has been handled from the get-go. I would have had a final agreement shortly after the March 26 framework, and we would not be here today. But were we standing in this position, my advice would be do full proration. I would give greater incentives to the players for an extended playoffs. I would also have a more serious commitment to social justice. I think this kind of recent announcement and the kind of the placards and the tweets that the owners have been sending out related to George Floyd's death and really the prominence of the Black Lives Matter movement, this actually cuts to the heart of the game itself and how the owners are so tone deaf relative to inner city youth, the increasing economic inaccessibility of the game because of showcase baseball, the whistleblower in the Dominican Republic and how the international players have been recruited early and families are getting abused. There's this whole notion of we, they. This is the owner's opportunity to flip the bit and to actually embrace the players and the larger baseball ecosystem and America as partners from a place of authenticity. And the problem is, Buster, the last three decades, they just haven't been there. So it's going to be hard for them to turn on a dime, which is why I think actually new leadership is needed.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the questions I've been asking folks in the game in the last 48, 72 hours, give me the name of an owner or two owners who would lead the other owners into the middle ground and say, look, we have to make a deal. It's important. And I get back a lot of silence where people are like, I can't identify that person. All right. I'm going to put you in capacity as advisor of the players. And I want to ask you this is you give your answer about what you would tell them. I feel like it's incredibly important for the players who do seem to have some leverage in this moment to whatever the deal is. There needs to be some bridges into the future, whether it's some kind of mechanism for relief for the free agent class that's going to get killed this winter or next winter or something that they can build on moving forward. Because I kind of cringe at the idea of a one quick victory if they get full prorated salary for, say, 70, 75 games, but no relief moving forward. What would you advise them?
So I think you're right. But I think the reality is, Buster, that there's not enough time to put something together that has real teeth relative to the 2021 CBA negotiation. I could not agree with you more. And I think those points that you recognize are kind of short-term, easy to add on pieces to a framework agreement. But the much bigger issue is how do we both change the incentives between owners and players, namely a real cap, a real revenue share, open book, full transparency, where players get to benefit from the revenue increases in broadcast rights, not simply having that all scooped out by the owners, and really embracing the players as partners. That's something that can't possibly happen now. This is only going to be a few tactical things, like you mentioned, good faith, and then coming back to the table with an economic revisit, in addition to addressing issues like tanking, manipulating service time, and these other bedrock issues that sadly the PA didn't take on in 2016.
All right, before you go, I'm going to throw a curveball at you because you're a numbers guy. I'm curious about how you feel about Jim Rice as a Hall of Famer, because you, as you well know, as a baseball fan, the sabermetricians say, no, no, he's not a Hall of Famer, but he was your favorite player growing up as a kid.
Buster, we can have a whole other podcast on that on that specific issue of sabermetrics. So the answer is, I think Jim Rice does deserve to be in the Hall of Fame,
yeah,
because what the numbers don't take into account was his dominance in that era and the feeling he elicited among pitchers on opposing teams when they used to put four outfielders out there because they were so scared of his bashing, you know, bashing the ball off the green monster and having it ricochet 100 feet in the other direction. He instilled a level of fear when he was at the plate that was hard to capture, that extends far beyond his pure numbers.
All right. I figured you'd say that. Thanks, Rog. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. Pardon any noise in the background. We got guys over
here.
What
do you got going on there today, Taylor? You know, is you like, is your wife rebuilding the kitchen while we do the podcast?
Oh, no. We have some guys power washing the deck, and she made a run for it as soon as they showed up because of the noise. So here I am podcasting with banging going on in the background. No big deal. We press on. First bleacher tweet up for today. Mitchell Tigers of Detroit writes in, even if there ends up being some sort of 2020 discussion, do you think the two sides may actually be more inclined to make sure there is not a strike in the following seasons? I imagine many more fans heading for the exits if this starts all over again. I think Mitchell may have a point. What do you think?
100%. And my sense is that the two sides are retrenching. I thought, you know, Roger really laid it out well about what's going on going forward. I mean, you can hear in the background the owners retrenching as we speak, Taylor.
Absolutely. Brad Wolf writes in at BWolf17. If they do play Major League Baseball, what about the minor leagues? Injuries will happen and the players need to come from somewhere to replace.
Yeah, they're going to have large groups of players available for each team, you know, something in the range of 50 players. So they'll have minor leaguers who will be available, and you're going to see 15,000 relief pitchers if they actually play games.
Oh, yeah. We got Tommy Boy at the Tommy Boy with an I. We get this question a lot, and I thought it would be fun to throw it in there. He writes, and I'm planning to start a baseball road trip for the next few years, and I figured I'd ask, besides stadiums and the Hall of Fame, what, in your opinion, is a baseball fan must-see on a road trip?
You know, I answered this question on Twitter yesterday, and I thought about it because it's interesting. Once you take Cooperstown out of it, you take the ballparks out of it, then, you know, I mean, you have things like near my house. I don't know if you knew this, Taylor, but near my house, Babe Ruth is buried.
So
it's less than 10 miles. And so I went down there and actually visited his grave during the winter with a neighbor. That was pretty cool. The Babe Ruth Museum is pretty cool. And we talked to Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City. That thing is that place is absolutely phenomenal. I encourage people to go to that.
Good stuff. Last one here. Throwing a curveball at you, Buster. My guy, T-Rock, a fellow ESPN podcast producer. He produces SV Pod and Marty Smith's America. He wants to know, and he's been pressing me, so I got to get the answer from you right now. Obviously, this changes on a daily basis, but would Buster Olney bet the family farm on baseball in 2020?
You know, I feel uncomfortable because, like, I bet the family farm on both sides of this thing as it's played out. as of this moment, I would bet the family farm that they will try to play.
Okay.
That they will eventually come up with an agreement. The owners are going to wear down the players. They'll eventually be in agreement to attempt to play. I'm not confident that they're actually going to be able to get through it without having the coronavirus manifest, but I would bet the farm at this moment that they would try to play. No one take the bet, please.
All right. All right. We'll allow that hedge for today. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Thanks for writing in, everyone.
That's it for today. My thanks to Roger, to Hannah, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. And remember, hate and inequality based on race is something we should fight every day. You hear the fight going on in the background at Taylor's house.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.